Welcome back, everybody, to this episode of the Latino Vote Podcast, your primary source of information on all things Latino Vote heading into the midterm 2022 elections. What a heck of a ride this has been, Chuck. I mean, from launching this thing back in the early summer, the growth on this, the attention on it has exploded in large part because we've had some extraordinarily talented people and some great voices, one of which I'm excited about introducing in just a moment. But you tell me, I mean, has this ride a few weeks out? Has this been what you expected?
You know, I was thinking about it earlier and we were texting about it last night that, you know, when we kind of came up with this theory of the case of all the information, the false information, people who didn't work in campaigns, and all of these people around the Latino voters talking about this. And we said we should create something and just give an honest answer, interview great people to talk about our community and our vote and the impact it would have. I wouldn't dream we would be like 15, 16 episodes in, talk to journalists from all over the country, activists. Like, I've really been blown away. But I think the thing that impresses me the most, and we were talking about this last night for y'all, is the amount of support we've gotten from across the gamut, from reporters to politicians to activists. There was a woman who will go unnamed who texted me the other day and was like, it's just refreshing to have one place and one voice. Once a week, I can get the download of everything that's been going on in our community and with our vote. And I really appreciate you and Mike doing that. So, Mike, it's been unbelievable for me.
I've really enjoyed it too, and I'm excited about what we're going to be doing post midterms because there's going to be so much to talk about. And regardless of how this shakes out, the whole narrative of Latino politics is dramatically changing. And there's no question that one of the people that will be writing that story and documenting it a lot is going to be our guest today, a good friend of mine. We've never had the opportunity to meet in person and engage in the debate with which he is most capable of determining, which is the flour tortilla versus corn tortilla debate we were talking about a little bit before the show. But I want to introduce Russell Contreras, who is one of the top writers on diversity issues, specifically the Latino community with Axios. Some of the articles that Russell comes up with, the topics, it's the deep dive on what I think are some of the drivers of what is happening in terms of politicization in our community. And we're going to talk about some of those because, Russell, I got a lot of great questions for you. But without further ado, I mean, Russell Contreras from Axios, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you too. Latino political consultants. I mean, excuse me, Latinx political consultants.
Oh, here we go. He's going to start some shit right now. Here we go.
One of the fascinating things about this window between 2020 and 2022 has been this examination of whether Latinos are moving rightward, whether they're not, why, you know, is it Mexicanos? Is it the Cubanos specifically? Is it Texas, Rio Grande Valley? Is it in Arizona? Why not California? Like all this stuff going on. You were really one of the first people to kind of lift up the hood and say, let's dig into this. And Axios did this really remarkable run of data and story about what was driving it. And I'm wondering if you can kind of talk to us about some of what you found that might defy conventional wisdom as it relates to the nation's perceptions about the Latino community.
Yeah, so we looked at a number of things. We've been doing polls with Telemundo and Ipsos. Just putting a pulse on what Latino voters think. And we made sure that we broke it down by ethnicity, by generation, by when your family came from your country of origin, to age, all sorts of things. And we found interesting is that, you know, for many years, it's been a 65-35, around that number of 65% of Latinos vote for Democrats, 35% vote for Republican. We saw an uptick when George W. Bush ran the first time. And ever since then, it's kind of hovering. What we've seen over the year, over in recent elections, is areas that were strongly Democratic, you're starting to see some changes or shifts. Not a lot, but enough to flip elections, whether there were small statehouse seats and then congressional elections. And this started to raise eyebrows among some folks, especially down in South Texas. One of the things that I saw that was interesting is if you looked at the number of Hispanic Protestants moving, evangelicals, you saw the greatest growth in South Texas, something that folks just didn't think about. in urban areas like Houston and Dallas, of course you're going to see more evangelicals because that's where mega churches are. Latinos are like everybody else. They've integrated in the community. They've, you know, experiment with religion and spirituality. It's happening. So if you put that in the mix, and that the fact that the Democrats have become a more stronger urban political party, neglecting some of the exurbs and rural areas where Latinos live. We're thinking of South Texas. We're thinking of West Texas. We're thinking of areas in New Mexico, one of the most rural areas, one of the most Hispanic, the most Hispanic state, that they're starting to see Republicans make inroads. And it's interesting that Republicans are making inroads without doing a lot of work. It's happening naturally. Mm-hmm. And that tells me that the Latino voters, Hispanic voters, mainly Mexican-American voters, we're talking about, we're only doing this shift organically. It wasn't through outreach. It was through natural things that were happening. So that was something that I just, that caught my eye.
I want to know whose dog is playing with a toy.
It is my new puppy here who is playing with him. I have to tell him not to, and he'll have to play with some other toys.
Hell, let him play with it. He's the only one on his podcast having any damn fun. Hell,
yeah.
What's your puppy's name?
His name is Chaco. He's only 8 weeks old, and we only had him for about 4 days.
We are a pro puppy podcast. I want to say that for everyone out there. We are big into the puppies. I'm actually going to talk about a puppy ad at the end of the segment today. But I think, Russell, to your point about what you were talking about, and it was a great question by Mike, is the deep dive into looking at the analytics of what's happening. What me and Mike have been discussing, which is very aggravating a lot of times, is people just pontificating about, oh, there's this big move to the Republicans by Latinos, or that all Latinos are Catholic and they're all anti-pro-choice, or they're this and they're that. And you can tell right away, they've probably never been to the neighborhood. They've never been to the local taqueria. They've never sat down with an abuela and figured out like how she's running shit in her house, right? But what your research shows is what's really happening. And as I was ticking off those things as you were talking about them. So I'm rural. I grew up in the middle of nowhere in a trailer park, 15 miles from the nearest city. I went to a Baptist church and got saved and baptized, went to work in a factory, which Mike Madrid likes because I can talk about working with my hands. And there's very few political operatives who ever actually worked in a factory and did that work. And so I was raised around those people you're talking about. My uncles were the choir directors in Baptist churches. And sometimes they were the only Latinos in those East Texas churches, you know? And I think that cultural competency that you just described in your reporting is what we really are hungry for on this podcast and in news as a whole. I want to shift gears and get into asking you some questions. And I want to, this is really for you and Mike. And I know Mike wants to talk about it. So I'm going to kind of be interviewing Mike on this one. But when we talk about this podcast, we want to keep up every week with hot button things that are happening in our community. And there's one thing we cannot get away from this week, and that is all the drama that is happening in LA and all the drama that is going on in Los Angeles with all the crazy stuff that's going on. I know that's Mike State. He's really involved in what's going on in local politics. And Russ, I know you cover this. So I'm going to actually ask Mike this question and then have him kick to you. But Mike, you want to give the viewers a little bit of a bird's eye view of what's really going on in Los Angeles and maybe talk about the background on this controversy?
Yeah, just from a high level, I think it's really important to understand that a rather significant developed, an unfortunate development has developed in Los Angeles City Hall. Los Angeles, of course, the largest Latino city outside of Mexico City, as I understand it. I mean, Los Angeles really is the Latino city of America. And what is changing? It's overwhelmingly Mexican American, but it's there's huge pockets of not just Central Americans and South Americans from all over the world. There's a lot of diasporas from different regions of Mexico, which caused some of the consternation that has developed over the last week. In fact, what happened was there was a recorded phone call between four very prominent Latinos in Los Angeles. One, the head of the Labor Federation, which is an extraordinarily powerful organization in person, not just in Los Angeles, but in California. Nuri Martinez, the first Latina president of the LA City Council. Kevin DeLeon, who many people may remember, was a primary challenger to U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the first Latino state president, state Senate president in California history. And then Gil Cedillo, who was an immigrants' rights activist in the California State Assembly and state Senate. Very, very prominent Latinos, some of the most prominent Latino politicians in California, which is you know, significant. Nuri was recorded surreptitiously, making some extremely horrific racialized comments. There was either tacit approval or a shameful silence by the other listeners. This has rocked City Hall. It's rocked the California Latino political establishment. It's had national reverberations, all the way up to the White House, where President Joe Biden has suggested that these folks need to resign. Really inexcusable language, but it opens up this kind of underbelly that is kind of demystifies this idea of Latinos ushering in this kind of perfect pluralistic new way of being, at least from the political perspective. And I think it's a moment, as unfortunate as it is, it's a moment of for reflection for the Latino community. And it's a moment where we have to be honest about some ugly skeletons in our own closet. But I'm also seeing some hopeful silver linings. I want to ask Russell's opinion on this, because he's written about this and Axios has covered it. Some of the first and most vocal advocates for resignation came in the form of Senator Alex Padilla, who knows a lot of these players personally, all of them personally. They came from groups like NALEO, the National Association of Latino Elected Officials, Arturo Vargas, who's an institution in California Latino politics, along with Helen Torres from HOPE, Hispanas Organized for Political Equality. And then if you saw the LA City Council chambers the next day after this story broke, it was flooded with overwhelmingly Latinos, obviously working in coalition with Black and Jewish and Asian Pacific Islander activists. But my point is, Latinos, I don't think it's a moment to say we're any better or anybody else or worse than anybody else on as far as racism goes. But I am pleased that there was this swift, strong movement to police it ourselves and say this is not acceptable in the community or in our politics. And I'm hoping that is also going to be remembered in the days that shake out. Because we have to do something as a community to start pushing for some sort of reconciliation, some sort of contrition, some sort of acknowledgement of this ugly part that so many of us know exists in our families, exists in other countries, and is a part of the legacy of colonialism. So, Russell, I mean, I want you to kind of take it from there and talk about some of the stories maybe you've covered and what you think this moment means.
You know, I kept thinking of in 2000. Remember, we started seeing these projections by the census that by mid-century Latinos will be the majority in the country, and you know, by 2020 we were going to be the largest non-white group of color, and all these kind of things. And I remember in the late 90s and 2000s when these stories were coming out, the Latino political leadership at the time kept saying, "Oh, we're going to solve all our problems. We're going to overwhelm you with our cultura and our and racism will be gone." And what this tells you is reinforcing what we knew internally, is that's not going to be the case. It's not about we shall overwhelm. It is still about we shall overcome. And when you come to these particular governmental entities, it's going to be reflective of those communities. And if we haven't had really honest discussions about anti-Blackness, about anti-Indigenous tropes and racism that it's going to reflect in the people you elect to office. Furthermore, I think that it was inevitable that something like this would explode. Look, Latinos are growing in every city across the country. African Americans, our populations are shrinking, or they're moving to the suburbs or exurbs because they can now afford to. So these historic wards are going to face pressure to change. So you're going to have these tensions. And this just reinforced what some Black leaders thought is why. If you take away these wars we fought since the Civil Rights Movement to create, and you're going to shrink them, we're not confident the people you put in office will understand our struggle. We're not confident that your people that you put in office will understand racism. And this confirms it. What's interesting, though, and I haven't been able to see the data on this, is that when you do create other wards that are mixed between Latinos and African-Americans, and this is what Neri Martinez's frustration was, is they couldn't elect Latinos even when they had like 70% of the people, residents there, most of them couldn't vote. They kept right. still electing African Americans. What I'm interested in is that sometimes when you pit an African American and a Latino running for an office, a seat, the African American usually wins. Why? You have a segment of Mexican Americans will say, I don't know who this random Mexican is, but I know this black person here has delivered for me in the past from local issues, fixing street potholes and delivering when I call about, you know, people selling drugs in the park, I can call this person. Case number one for this is the reelection of Sheila Jackson Lee over the time in Houston, Texas. She came from a historic black district that has over time become more Latino, and she keeps winning. Why? Mexican Americans keep voting for her. There's no interest, no matter what you say about her, her issues, her problems, and all this, they will keep voting for her. In the city of Houston, we've had two black mayors who've won on the backs of Latino voters. There's never been a Latino mayor. This tells you that black political leaders are better right now at coalition building. They have the diplomacy. They have the experience. We are still running and winning elections where we're the big majority, right? And for this part, mainly Democrats have not given the resources for Latinos to run when they are not the majority. And if you look in Oregon, you had the woman named Salinas. She was running where she was not the majority in a Democratic primary. The House Majority PAC was supporting a crypto bro because they didn't think this Latina could win in a non-Latino majority district. So this is something that we need to have a totality of a conversation, and it's going to reflect our racism, and we need to prepare to have it.
So I want to, that's great. I've got some holes I want to fill from just reading this morning. Not that I know more about this than these two guys, but you should remember that Gil Cedillo, who was in the room, was not reelected in the last primary. So
right.
people have asked him to step down. He probably won't, in my opinion, because he's just going to be there for three more months and then his seat is gone. He was beat by a progressive Latina. Keep that in mind. Also, this is an old recording. This is not something that happened last week. This happened right after they got into office and they had made their way over to the AFL-CIO's county building, which is the seat of power, like Mike said, and they had had this recording there. So it got recorded in the union building, and the union president now has went as far as to say that his office had been bugged. Either here nor there, this is how it's kind of the back end of how this went down, because I was curious and it answered a lot of questions for me as an old labor organizer. Also in L.A., you need to remember this. There ain't no Republicans in the L.A. City Council, no Republicans involved in L.A. politics. This is our own family of Democrats fighting each other. And normally what happens in L.A. is you have two kinds of Democrats who end up running against each other. You have a more pro-business, moderate, I would say, middle-of-the-road Democrat who's normally running against a Bernie Sanders Democrat, and that's what ends up normally being the two sides of these races. All of these dynamics you should keep in mind, because guess what? Neri stepped down now. She's given up her seat. So now there's probably going to be a special election. I tweeted about this yesterday. So there'll be a special election, and I guarantee it's going to end up being a progressive Democrat against a moderate or regular Democrat. The other two points I want to make is in this city, and this is what Russell was alluding to, is there's a lot of seats in Congress that are represented by Black folks in LA that have majority Latino populations, which has became a friction point between the two communities. And this could have been part of what these conversations were about. It don't excuse a damn thing. I'm just giving you information. But if you look at the Long Beach mayor, Robert Garcia, Long Beach was a Black area for a long time. That part out there between going from LA to the beach where Nanette Barragan is the congresswoman, lots of Black folks used to live in Compton. Now Compton is a Latino area. But historically, Black folks had voted at higher propensities than Latino folks in primaries. Mike Madrid talks about the lineage of we're not Black, we don't act like Black voters, because there's such an institutional pride in voting because of what they fought for. And so that's a dynamic. I lay all of this at your feet just to remind you to keep all that in mind when you're reading about all this. And Mike, did I leave anything out or spurn you about anything that I left out?
I mean, there's so much. That was perfect. You know, the richness that you added to this story, and it's very complex, and I think it's very important. And again, I think what is going to be fascinating is to see the many threads that come out of this. I think another one is the realization that all four of these folks really catalyzed their political professions, their political involvement and activism as a result of Proposition 187, which is the irony of Latinos, you know, getting involved politically because of discrimination, because of white oppression on their voices being heard. And now that they are in the positions of power, behaving not only the exact same way, but arguably worse. Right. And so there's a story of black brown tension, which has really gripped Los Angeles since the late 90s. White brown tension, which has gripped it from the same time. This emergent demographic group, which is also driving so much of the tension in the country, by the way. Right. This what California was going through in the 1990s is what the rest of the country is going through now. And that's why this narrative, I think, is so important. It's so dangerous. It's so hurtful, but it's also so promising. And that's that we've got to really unpack all of this that's happening, because there is a mythology about Latinos maybe ameliorating the racial discord that we always looked for, saying, well, between black and whites, there's brown area, and we're not going to focus on race just as much. I think this really, really blows a hole through that myth, which I've largely bought into as well. And that just changes things. It's disappointing. But I think that there's going to have to be a lot written on it, because I don't think it just goes away. I don't. No, I could be wrong. No. But I think it's a profound moment generationally in Latino politics, not just in L.A., not just in California, but nationally. I mean, Russell,
that's my question to Russ, is that this is my question to you, Russell, because I think Mike laid it out really good, is that this recording was a year ago. Somebody dropped this. Keep in mind, I'm an old black ops guy. I'm an old labor guy. I know all of these tricks. I was in the rooms when a lot of this stuff had talked about way back in the day. Like, this is not something new to me. And it's not lost on me that this tape was dropped 30 days before the election, before there's an election in LA. This is something that is not lost on me. If somebody did this on purpose, keep in mind, for those of you listening at home like me who may not know all the ins and out of California politics like Mike, Mike is understating a little bit about just how these three people were three of Latino icons nationally because of the number of people they represented. They came up with Alex Padilla. They came up with all these Congress people that are around there. Like, these are big time leaders now that have taken a direct hit. Now, Russell, this is the question, is as you are working in politics, working in reporting, working in covering our community nationwide, I'd be interested at what you're hearing from other leaders, other reporters, other thought leaders about what's going on in LA now.
Yeah, that's a good question. I know my friends at the LA Times, like Gustavo Arellano, the columnist there, they were like, they're looking into, okay, what's the fallout? Why does this matter? Okay, we've got it. It's out there. The controversy is there. But what is also, and Mike, you tweeted about, I think you tweeted about this, is Yuri Martinez, what does she know? You know, she may have receipts of others who are saying, well, okay, you got me, but I also have some information on all of you who are right now being holier than thou. Because these conversations, I mean, they were just horrific. They were racist. But we all know similar conversations go around across this country. And you can't tell me right now, we did a story on this a few months ago, that there were redistricting fights, not just in LA, but also Chicago, Milwaukee, Houston, Dallas, and they all have the same thing: growing Latino populations, shrinking black populations. What is a just way to redistrict these areas? And if these people in Los Angeles are having those discussions, what are those discussions elsewhere? We don't have the recordings. We don't know. Maybe I should be idealistic and say, no, none of them had racist conversations. It's just LA. I find that hard to believe. We just got this. This is, I talked to a political scientist and said, this was the curtain being thrown away and we saw the racism before our eyes. We know conversations like this happen. And I think this basically confirms the fears of a lot of black leaders. But this is not the first time. And we've been having this debate as Latinos for a long, ever since we got involved in politics. I can take you back to the 1950s between former LULAC president Felix Tejerina, a restaurateur Republican, who believed we had to fight civil rights by just focusing on ourselves. And he even said it, let the black man fight his own battles. John J. Herrera, a previous LULAC president and more progressive Democrat, said, no, this is about human rights. We cannot divorce ourselves from the black struggle. We have to be intertwined. And they had very heated discussions about it. And it basically was a fight over LULAC, about tactics. And while we're fighting this, African Americans were watching us and said, you guys can't get your mess together. Why should we form coalitions when I think half of you don't even want to be with us. So those are things while we fight, and we fight on the open. Let's just be honest. We don't hide things. I wish we could at times, because if we're trying to build coalitions, whether it's from the right or left, when we throw things out there, it puts this image that we can't be trusted, that we're just full of drama. It's stereotypical because everybody has it. We're just more honest about it at times. And this recording just shows how honest we can be, even when it's hurtful.
I think that's a fantastic observation. I mean, truly. And the history, like I said, the history of this struggle for Latinos determining really, one is how much we should be in coalition with our Black brothers and sisters, how much we can relate to their struggle, the honest earnestness of leaders in the past saying, does this help or hurt the Hispanic cause? And there's, you know, been various opinions. It's part of the legacy of just the racial dynamic in politics in this country. And I got to tell you, I got a lot of calls from a very prominent federal figure whom I will not name about this, saying these folks should not resign because we are going to lose too much. And my response was a little bit of shock and dismay, saying, who's we? Like, we is Los Angeles. We is like the whole city. It's a community. It's not a Black and brown struggle. And if we cede to that, then what are we? Like, what happens to democracy when we allow ourselves to be kind of balkanized like this? And that's a criticism that has come from both sides of the political aisle. And again, I don't want to belabor this topic too much because there's so much to talk about right now. But I do want people, especially outside of California, to really appreciate how significant this moment is. It's a true redefinition and a new understanding, not just of what was said, not just where it was said, which is very important, not just who the players were, but what the community is going to do afterwards. Because even though I think everybody's still in a little bit of shock right now, the politicians, of course, are going to do the whole unity dance and we're going to all come together. But the truth of the matter is, this really redefines Latinos' narrative about themselves politically and what that means and how we're going to approach things. Are we going to double down and kind of advocate for the interests of particularly Black but increasingly aspiring Asian Pacific Islander numbers, which are growing faster than Latinos in California now? Or you know, do we kind of double down on this mythology that, again, we are ushering in a new era where some of this stuff will go away? And I just I'm fascinated to kind of watch that discussion and plan. I'm excited about the way reporters cover it, because it says a lot about race in America, not just about Latinos, not just about Blacks and whites, but all of us and our perception of self.
And this also puts in a point where, you know, for years we've been waiting for that Latino Messiah to come in, become that national figure, whether it's from the right or left. Mm-hmm. And I remember in middle school, when I grew up in the 80s outside of Houston, Texas was a fundamentally different place. Our textbooks were different. We actually had a section in my eighth grade history textbook about Henry Cisneros, the current mayor of San Antonio at the time. And it said he possibly could be the first Hispanic mayor or the Hispanic president. Of course, it never happened because of a lot of scandals. A lot of us have internalized, the Messiah will probably come from Southern California. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't happened because it's been scandal after scandal. And it's really frustrating when I'm watching this and I'm looking at, as a reporter, seeing whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, oh, that person's going to be the national figure. Oh, that person's going to do that. This will help put it to rest that we're not as American. We can be part of a national political conversation. And in each case, something brings them down. And it's usually men. There have occasionally been some other women. Loretta Sanchez is a good example. Mm-hmm. But there have always been men where it's a sex scandal, a monetary scandal, corruption, or now in this case, racist leaked audio. And it basically destroys the bench, and you have to start over, because as you know, it takes years building a persona that this person can get elected outside of the district. This person knows about our foreign policy and the rest of the country. They could be a national figure. It never happens.
I'm going to move us on to another topic, but I want to button this up by saying, you know, I think that I want all of our sisters and brothers that are listening to the podcast, many of which are Black, many of which are Afro-Latino, and Afro-Latinos are not talked about enough in all of the society that we deal with. And that, you know, here at the podcast, and I'm not going to speak for Mike, but Mike's talked about the original sin here on the podcast. And I want people to know that this is the exception, not the rule. Is racism in the Latino culture? Sure, but it's in every culture. But that doesn't mean everybody is that way. That doesn't mean everybody thinks about it in that way. Those of you who follow me for 10 seconds know I'm engaged to a beautiful Black woman who every day teaches me and opens up my eyes to something different and something new. It's a culture of mending together, all of us, to understand a common struggle, but also a common opportunity. You know, I've learned that as I've gotten older, that we have to be there to support each other. And if we just focus on all the nastiness that can happen from time to time like this, not that you take it lightly. I think that it's been dealt with. I think that it's been dealt with people standing up within our own party to call these people out, hold them accountable, and move on. But I want you to know here on this podcast with me and Mike that that's the exception, not the rule, and that we lift up our brothers and sisters, and we think that the coalition is the way that this community moves forward. Russell, can you give us your take on the recent Axios reporting about what's going on in Texas 15 and the DCCC pulling
out? Yeah, Texas Democrat Michelle Viejo, a progressive running in a majority Hispanic Rio Grande Valley district against Republican Monica de la Cruz. She's not getting any DCCC support in her district, where Trump won about 3 points. House Majority PAC is planning to cancel the scheduled ad reservations at the end of the month, according to our sources. And this is part of a larger deal where both parties are starving out weak candidates. For some reason, they think Michelle's a weak candidate against Monica de la Cruz. If you get emails from Monica de la Cruz, she also thinks she is at a fundraising disadvantage. So this appears out from the outside as a very competitive seat. But for whatever reasons, the higher-ups in this case, the Democratic Party, are saying they need to abandon this race and shift their resources where they have a better chance of winning. If this happens, this could be historic down there. This is, of course, part of the redistricting part of what the Republican-controlled Texas state legislature enforced, that it could flip. It could flip to the Republicans anyway. But for many folks there in Texas, they're very angry because they said, this is still a winnable seat. This is, you just got to do the work. You got to get out people to vote. And this is frustrating across the board. I see the same thing in New Mexico, where people on the other side, Republicans, are saying privately, you can shift more money in these districts to win some of these statehouse seats where Hispanic Republicans have a chance to win if you give the resources here and you do the work. That's not happening right now.
I think that's a remarkable change, too. I mean, just it strikes me, and again, as an old guy who's been kind of observing for so long, the narrative in this election cycle, I don't think people realize how significantly different it is. This is like a 70% plus Latino population district. The Democrats are walking away. I don't care about what any of the dynamics are. The idea that somehow, sometime, there would be that Democrats would walk away from a 70% Hispanic district is absolutely mind blowing. It just is. Or if you look at Nevada, where it's like they're, you know, you've got Democrats now saying, well, you know. Cortez Masto is going to get, 60% of the Hispanic vote. Yeah, that means you're going to lose 40% of the Hispanic vote. Like that's extremely significant. And there's just this sort of lack of awareness of how I think we've kind of passed through the Rubicon where people are saying, well, the Republicans aren't winning, the Hispanic vote. And I don't know anybody who's been a serious student of the Latino vote saying Republicans are going to win the Latino vote. What we're saying is there's going to be margins. Republicans are peeking into the margins at a point where it's making it hard for Democrats to remain competitive. And man, it's happening in 70% Hispanic districts. It's happening in Clark County, Nevada. It's happening.
Southern New Mexico, too. Southern New Mexico, the district that's run right now by Yvette Herald, represented by Yvette Herald, a Republican, a very strong Trumper, she beat Xochitl Torres Small in 2020, flipped the seat. She was a moderate, moderate Dem, became flipped to Republicans. Xochitl Torres Small was getting attack because she was too moderate in an area that had gone strong for Trump. But yet she was straddling that role. And so she loses. And so what do Democrats do? They nominate a very progressive candidate who has said, you know, he wants to abolish ICE. This is along the border where a lot of Mexican Americans work for the Border Patrol. This is one of the most, this is the most Latino district in the most Latino state. But yet Republicans are probably going to keep this seat. They're not giving this much resource, giving this much, this race as many resources. And they passed on other candidates that could have done. I talked to a guy named, well, I knew that Damon Martinez was considering running for the seat, the former U.S. attorney who was very moderate. He got beat by Deb Haaland when she ran in a very contested race for an open seat in Albuquerque. And she became the first Native American to in Congress, one of the first Native American females in Congress. But during that race, this moderate Dem who had served in Kuwait, who is in the National Guard, who had all, he was like a dream candidate. The progressive attacked him as being a, quote, fascist because he was on law enforcement side, even though he was responsible for getting in the Justice Department to investigate Albuquerque police, which resulted in the consent decree. That was still not good enough. Yeah. While he wanted to talk about national security, his military experience, holding Trump accountable, the race came down to is what is his stances on your progressive issues that most people in Albuquerque did not know. And because we had a close primary in Albuquerque, close primary in New Mexico, only the most progressive Democrats voted. He loses, and he doesn't even run for the seat. He says, I'm not worth it. I'm not going to have the resources.
I want to bring this back a little bit and talk about Texas 15, and then I can transfer to those other districts. And for those of you who are listening to this podcast, you know I'm not a fan of the DCCC. I'm open about my hate for the DCCC because I think that they've run a lot of the ways local politicians and local activists would run their own congressional races. I hear that everywhere I go, the DCCC comes in. They bring in all these white consultants from D.C. They don't know our community. They run. Russ is shaking his head because he hears the same thing I do, right? Mike Madrid's heard the same thing. Like, they come in and they just take over. And they take over with their consultants, with their messaging, with mainly white folks. And it's just like, it's not good campaigning, and it drives me crazy. So let's talk about a few facts. And I'm trying to stay calm here. But in Texas 15, this district is not a Republican district. And Mike Madrid, it is not 70% Latino. It is 79% Latino, Hispanic, almost 80%. It starts in McAllen, and it goes all the way up to the San Antonio suburbs. And people tweeted at me yesterday, well, Chuck, it's gotten a lot more Republican because it's in the suburbs. I'm like, don't give me that shit. It's still 68% registered Democrats in this district. There are more registered Democrats than Republicans. Beto O'Rourke carried the way the district is drawn right now. He would have won this district in 2018. This is what me and Mike Madrid for 30 years would be the classic swing district. That means it's not more than 5 points Republican or 5 points Democrat, and you should be fighting to try to win those seats. And for the Democrats to walk away, let me rephrase that, the national Democrats, the local Democrats have not given up. The state party chairman this week made a comment, who's from the area as well, that we shouldn't be walking away from these districts. Y'all mark my word, this is what's going to happen. She's going to put up a hell of a fight, Michelle. She probably loses by a couple of points if somebody from the outside don't come in, and I've got plans for this to try to help her win. And then the narrative is we have to deal with a damn Monica de la Cruz down there who's a Trump Latina in Congress for 2 years where the Republicans can say, look, we're the party of Latinas. We're the party of Mexicans. We're the party of people who legally migrate here. We're the party of, and it just is a horrible narrative that makes me have to work even harder to win other districts that are right next to this damn district that are also swinging more Republican. Because when you start comparing this district to the Vicente district or the Henry district, don't bring that shit to numbers people like me and Mike. Mike's taught me enough about enough numbers to call bullshit on all of that. Vicente's district is D plus 16, and they are spending $3 million to try to help a guy in a district that's D plus 16. Good for them. They should. Vicente's my friend. I hope that he wins and beats her ass. But that tells you enough to know if they're spending $3 million, Mike, to defend a district that's D plus 16 for shit's sake, or Henry Cuellar, whose district is D plus 7. and they're spending millions of dollars. That tells you exactly what's going on the ground, doesn't it, Mike?
Not only does that, but here's the real fascinating thing, and Russell said this in the intro, and I'm gonna leverage this that excellent soliloquy into a question for Russell. A lot of this, whether it's in the Rio Grande Valley, whether it's in the San Antonio suburbs, whether it's in southern New Mexico, whether it's in Clark County, Nevada, it's happening despite Republicans' efforts. It's not like they've got some silver bullet or something is working differently than in the past. And, you know, I'm sure as a reporter, you're hearing them saying, well, we invested in these campaign headquarters and you know, we're doing these rallies and shit. It's like everybody who knows campaigns goes, yeah, okay, that's important optics, but that's not moving the needle, right? There are larger demographics at play. And if the Democrats want to remain competitive, they're going to have to adjust. They have to adjust, and there's just still this deep-pocketed denial about what is happening. The good news for Democrats, and I'm not advocating for or against Democrats, I'm advocating for my community, is that the Republicans haven't figured this out either. They're getting this despite their best efforts. Talk to us a little bit more about that. You mentioned that in the intro, and I think you're exactly right.
Yeah, Ruben Gallego, the congressman from Arizona, said something really interesting is when we interviewed him for our Vision Audios event a couple of weeks ago for Axios Latino. He was saying the problems he sees, and of course he's the chair of Bold Pack, the political arm of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, that the political consulting classes look at Latinos very simplistic. They don't break it out like they do with white voters, white working class voters who shop at Walmart or who are hunters, or who may or may not support abortion, who go to mainland Protestant churches versus evangelicals. He says they don't do that with Latino voters. They just see Latino voters, they may break out in class, but it's like they generalize and they don't break out. And when you confront them, they get very defensive because they don't have a plan to do that. A lot of, as you know, these races are won with using very good information called data. If you have data, you can deploy resources to make sure that data gets out and vote. These are people. These are concerns. You can focus on those issues. And as we talked, he said, I wish they would do that. But it will disrupt the political class because they tend to be largely white. And he said that's both on the Republican and Democratic side, that if you've got more Latinos on both, they could tell you, if you go down to South Texas, there's a growing evangelical movement. This is what resonates. If you go down to southern New Mexico, who also includes parts of oil country, this is what you should talk. And I keep thinking of this. In eastern part of New Mexico, where I live in central New Mexico, but the eastern part, oil and gas is the big driver of the economy there. And it is what drives this poorest state in the country. Without oil and gas, we have no revenue for education. We have no revenue for roads. Who works in oil and gas industry? Who's the people? Latinos. So when someone from the East Coast says, I support the Green New Deal and we want to get off fossil fuels, those voters who were traditionally Democrats say, wait a minute, you're taking away my job. And they'll say, well, we're going to give you job training. No, if I have a $90,000 a year job or $110,000 a year job, you're going to take it away. I need a next job that next week that pays me the same. You cannot give me a green job yet, working at a wind farm, right, making the same amount of money. So before you can have that discussion, you need to come up with an alternative or you're going to lose those voters. And then you won't even get any discussion about climate change because you've alienated a segment of this coalition that you need in order to win, in order to pass your policies.
That is gold right there. I hope everybody was listening to that and taking notes. If not, rewind that, because that is exactly the cultural divide between Democrats and Republicans. Is there is a blue culture, there is a blue collar culture in the United States that is rapidly becoming more and more Latino. And you cannot tell somebody working in the oil patch making $100,000 a year that they're going to be retrained or that they're somehow going to get a job installing solar panels because one, they know that it's bullshit, but two, those jobs don't exist now. And it's easy for you in California or New York or Washington, D.C. to say, well, we're doing this to save the planet. Yeah, that may be the case, but you're going to put me out of work? You're going to destroy the tax base that educates my children, that pays for healthcare? Like, that's not even a real consideration. So well put, wonderfully put. Chuck, I interrupted you.
There's a reason why Ruben Gallego is, this, my opinion, one of the smartest politicians in Washington, D.C. And that's because if you know Ruben, or if you've read his book, and I really, really should tell you, you should go buy his book about his deployments. He's a war veteran. He was in the Marines. But that don't make Ruben smart. That made Ruben who he is. Ruben could answer the question like Russ just asked him, because Ruben grew up on a couch in Chicago with a single mother, where he had a bunch of sisters, and he didn't even get a bedroom, Mike. He had to sleep in the living room on the couch because there wasn't a place for him to stay as the only male in the house, and worked and had nothing and poured himself up. He's the closest to the pain, and I'll tell you that to say that's what makes him a damn good congressman and connected to the community so well, right? So then let's look at these districts again in South Texas and who's running them. Who's running the races in southern New Mexico? Who's running the races in many of these places? The point that drives me crazy, y'all, and you are making my point while I'm bringing it up again, and I don't care. It needs to be said again, that if we think that that's the reason he's smart, and I do, then why in the hell in all three of these congressional seats that are all three almost 80% Latino, does all three of the Democrats have a white campaign manager, a white messaging and media firm, a white digital firm, and a white mail firm? Like, there's no Latinos making a strategic decision in districts that are 80% Latino. That doesn't mean that these white people are bad or that they're not good operatives. They are damn good operatives. And I'm happy that they've got jobs. Some of them are literally my friends and I've had lunch with them. But I'm just saying, when is there a time for Latinos to have a place at that table in a district, at least in that district? Maybe we don't have and run the campaign in Maine, which I could make a case for why we could do that in Maine or in Michigan or any gosh damn where. But especially in these seats that have so many of our people, where somebody's sitting around a table, and Mike Madrid, I'm looking at you because you've been in that room where they're like, what'd the poll say? What should the ad say? What should the mail say? And there's not a brown face sitting at that table except for a congressional candidate or a congressman who probably knows the county and the districts better than anyone. So I assume, and I know Vicente does, they speak up and say, here's what our people are saying. But they're the only ones nuancing that message. So I think that's where we lose a lot of this cultural competency, when there's not any Latinos. Sure, is it self-serving to say, hire brown consultants? Shit, yeah, it is. But Chuck Rocha ain't the only one who owns a brown consulting firm. I can give you a list of 10. And the one thing I know about them is they all are just like Russ. They sit in the community. They know what the community's saying, whether it's Mike in Sacramento, Chuck in D.C., or Tyler, Texas. Like, there's just something you lose if you're not there. And I think the crux of this, and this is part of the questions because I want to get to some polling with Mike, is that if you have people who are asking the same polling questions to the same group of people and you're getting back the same answers, you see a lot of the messaging being the same. And me and Mike have been critiquing a lot of these ads that seem kind of culturally disconnected from the community, Russ, and messaging that maybe not fits southern New Mexico or South Texas or even the Central Valley of California, because you can tell it wasn't made by somebody from our community. Are you coming across that with what you're seeing?
Yeah, you know, there have been cases, without saying anything, campaign, where I get messages and I'll call and say I'm working on the story, and I'll get a white political consultant or a white spokesperson of a Hispanic candidate and say, this is not a story, you're getting it all wrong, Republicans are running against the sea, whatever. And then they say, let me explain something to you about the Hispanic community. That's what this happened every time. And so at first, I thought it was one of you playing a joke on me. You were recording me, and you were going to
clown me. That's exactly what we would do.
But then I'm like, wait a minute, this person's serious. Yeah. And then occasionally I get angry. I look, I know this community. I'm from this community. I've been covering this community for a long time. It's a story. One, I disagree with you. It's a story, and I'm going to write it. Two, it's a little condescending. Just because you studied us in college doesn't mean that you're an expert. And I get that you can do data researches, and I respect that. But I think a lot of times they see us as political data pawns, mm-hmm. points, not as people that need to be engaged. And look, yes, the data in history is important, but you could also do the work. And I keep going back to 1960, where John F. Kennedy was running for president and he had to win West Virginia. The data, the numbers, the consultants told him, you can't. You're a Catholic going into a largely white Protestant area. They will not like you. They will not see you as one of them. You're a rich guy. But then he went and did the work. he went and he beat Hubert Humphrey, and it became this national moment where a Catholic can win in the most Protestant white working class area, and not only win, but win well. And if he could win there, he could win anywhere, right? They did the work, and it was where he saw something else that they didn't see. And what I think you two, you see something else what others can't see, both on both sides of the aisle. And it's very hard for people to give up the power, because this is a business. This is a racket. This deals with money. And any time you change that, you're changing their racket. You're changing their bottom line. Why would I do that? Well, you have to, because the nation's changing and the rules are changing, and therefore you need to change too.
Before I turn this podcast back over to Mike Madrid, I want to let all of our listeners know I'm going to step out at 4 o'clock because there's a big meeting going on with some Latino leaders here in D.C. that I want to make sure that I'm a part of, because I helped put it together. It was a last minute thing. We're getting close to the elections and these things are happening, just like Mike had to do an interview last week. But I want to thank you, Russell, before I have to go, for being on the show. I'm going to leave you with Mike, who's got a set of questions. I think he's on page 4 of the questions that he has for you. So don't let him keep you here all afternoon. I want to thank the listeners for listening to me today. And I want to thank Russell for all the great reporting he's done. But I'm going to turn it over to my much better half. I know a lot of you come to hear me, so I'd ask you not to tune out. Mike is good. Give Mike a chance. Mike can run this podcast without me. But until next week, I will see y'all then. And Mike, thank you for putting up with all my bullshit.
Russell, we don't have a whole lot of time left. I mean, we did schedule this so that Chuck could make this this hard stop, but I also want to kind of tap into that brain while we've got you here. What do you think? And again, I'm not going to ask you to predict where the vote's going to go, Latino vote's going to go this year. I mean, there's data all over the place, and there's going to be all sorts of narratives, and both parties are going to, you know, position what they're going to say. But as a journalist, as somebody who's caught like in the middle of this vortex, and it's exciting because you're literally writing the narrative of this unfolding demographic change, but no one's really happy with the way you convey it, right? The Republicans are like, that's not what's happening. Democrats are like, that's not what's happening. What do you think? I mean, is there any common thematic that could possibly be the driver from between 2022 and 2024 that, regardless of what happens, is going to be different?
I think what's going to happen is you're going to see marginal shifts and you're going to see trends, and then people will freak out about trends. If you talk to some people in the Biden administration, they expect that, you know, the majority of Latinos will be Protestant and the majority of Latinos could be a Republican by 2030 or 2040, right? And if things don't change. And then some of them have given up saying, oh, well, this is the way it is. Others are saying, well, if you give up, you're admitting that you don't want to do the work. This is now, I think you've said it, one of the most swingy voting blocks. But you have to divide it up between Mexican-Americans in Texas, Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles, Puerto Ricans and Dominicans in New York, and Cuban-Americans and Colombians in Florida. These are populations that almost have nothing to do with each other besides Mexican-Americans in Cali and Texas. But if you look at the experience of Cuban-Americans and Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles or Houston, you're going to see fundamentally different narratives and different political conclusions. And that's okay. That's totally fine. You're not going to come to the same political conclusions if you have different family histories. That's fine. But I think what happens a lot is people want to lump all of us together in one group and call it Latino or Latinx or whatever, mm-hmm. because it makes our numbers bigger than African-Americans. Let's mm-hmm. be honest. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. Second is a lot of these nonprofit organizations are put together because parties want a one-stop shop where they can give their money and they tell you to go get that people out to vote. Don't ask them what the hell they feel. Go out and get them a vote. Engage them. Yeah, whatever. You want this, whatever. But get them out to vote and that's it. That model is broken and it no longer works.
So with that in mind, you know, Russell, as we start to wrap up here, let me ask you kind of the one big perplexing question. Is there such a thing as a Latino vote? Will we be talking about a Latino vote in 5, 7, 10 years?
I think they'll still be talking about it because they have not no other way to discuss it. I mean, it's very difficult. Even I was at a gathering in Aspen, Colorado, kind of like a Latino Big Ideas event. And when I brought up to some of the activists, why don't we divide this up so that we can analyze it? I get pushback to say, well, don't divide us. You know, this is about divisions. There's already this culture that you cannot divide up the Latino vote by using, instead of saying the euphemism, you know, Latino vote is not a monolith. Okay, well, let's break it up and discuss what the different breaks are. But when you do that, there's pushback to say, you're being divisive. Well, no, it's not divisive by saying facts. Cuban Americans tend to vote Republican because of their experience. Mexican Americans in LA tend to vote Democratic. And you put them together and you expect them to get along. When really, if we're really being honest, if you put them in the same room, they will not like each other if you talk about politics. They have totally different worldviews. That's okay. You can wear a Che Guevara shirt in LA. If you wear a Che Guevara shirt in Miami, you're going to get your ass kicked. Right. That's okay. That's the reality. But you can't lump us together and say we're doing this because your particular nonprofit needs the grant money so you can continue to do voter outreach so that you can say you have those numbers. So I think over time, it's going to force the country to say that there's many votes. I think it's easier to say the Mexican-American vote. It's easier to say the Central American vote and the Dominican-American vote. And then even there, there's nuances, just like there is the white vote. It's very seldom to say white voters all over the place because you can't compare a white voter outside of Methuen, Massachusetts with a white voter out in West Virginia or a white voter out in Nebraska. They have totally different worldviews, different religions, different set of concerns, different set of priorities. And the same thing is with Latinos, whether I'm my family is based in Houston. Those Mexican-American voters have a lot of different concerns than a Mexican-American voter, even in El Paso, Texas. Mm-hmm. It's 800 miles away. It's a world of difference. Even the food is different. So if those are different, you can't expect them to all come to the group and say, my candidate, I agree with this candidate, or I agree with this worldview. And here's something else I want to bring up, because this rarely gets discussed. We've talked about the Protestant and the evangelical movement among Latinos. The other big growing movement among Latinos, the highest growing in terms of religion, are Latino nuns, N-O-N-E-S, nothing. They don't have any affiliation with religion. They're agnostic, they're atheists, they're spiritual but not religious. They see evangelicals as antithetical to the whole worldview. They don't believe that you can have a discussions with Jesus Christ more as so as you have in the discussions with Thor. They're one of the fastest growing segments in among Latinos, but they're not organized. They're not organized. So there's something there. Now, where do they go politically? I don't know, because we have not explored it.
It's starting to look like non-Hispanic whites.
Right.
Right. This overall disaffiliation. And is that the story? Is that what's happening?
It could be. It could be. I think that is the view. And then I think the new generation that's coming up, we make fun of them. We call them wokosos or super woke, right? And it's totally fair. The Gen Z generation is very different from a Gen X, where we just didn't care. They're going to come with a different worldview about sexuality, gender roles, and that's perfectly – that's fine. And I think they're going to redefine both parties. But we have not seen the end of this story yet. It's going to evolve. And I'm really curious to where we are 10 years from now, whether after this election, instead of Democrats saying we need to do work, they'll just start blaming Latinos. You guys blew it. We've done all this for you, and this is how you appreciate it. And then all of a sudden you say Republicans, well, maybe we should tone down this rhetoric about an invasion. I don't think that's going to happen. And then they'll say, you know what? Maybe we should let more people from Latin America. We should have open borders because these people are coming out with conservative views. Why not? Right?
Right.
We look at the polling. They agree with a lot of the Republican social issues. These immigrants from Mexico, they're praying before they cross over. The evangelicals. And maybe it's the Democrats who will say 10 years from now, no, we need to vet them. We need to know who's coming in. Right? Yeah. We don't need to let anti-trans folks or anti-gay folks in or anti, but we need to you see where they are. That's not a far-fetched possibility. No. I think that's when they could happen.
Especially when you put it just that way, just to watch the malleability of political parties and to see what's happened with the Republican Party in recent years. I think that's a fascinating observation. Look, the truth is, I don't know where any of this is going to be in 10 years, but I fully intend to have a ticket to the ride. And the good part is, I know that you will be narrating it along the way. Russell, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time. I love, love, love your work. One real quick question. If the Dodgers and the Astros meet in the World Series, Will the Dodgers win in four games or five?
I think that's you're speaking like some of the Democratic consultants you criticized. You're not looking at the data and the history, and you got to do the work, Mike. You just can't walk in there. LA just stinks. They run the world, but you're going against the Hanals, and so it's probably going to be seven Astros. And this time there'll be no complaints about us, quote, cheating. You know, it was fair and square last time. It's going to be fair and square this time.
Brother, I love having you on. Love your work, and good luck this October. We will talk to you hopefully again soon, shortly after, because, man, I can't wait to see what the narratives are going to be post-election cycle and as we head into the 2024 presidential. Thanks for being with us.
Let's do it. Appreciate it.